Okay, let's get started. Our third speaker, Peter Galbraith, is on the way. His flight was a little late, and so he says he's about 5 minutes away, but I told him we'd start the program, and he can just come in. He won't be speaking first anyway. So he should be here in a couple minutes, but I think we ought to go ahead and get started. We don't want to start too late. Welcome to the Independent Institute's Policy Forum on Iraq and Afghanistan. You will undoubtedly hear a different point of view from the Democratic administration or the Republican opposition here today. Our panel today consists of Peter Galbraith, a former Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary of General of the UN to Afghanistan and former Assistant Secretary General of the UN. And also, he's the former Ambassador to Croatia. So that's a lot of titles there. Chuck Pena, who is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, and myself. And I'm Ivan Elin, the Institute's director of the Center on Peace and Liberty. I'll also speak first, because I'm standing up here, and I'll moderate the question and answer. So you'll be seeing a lot of me, I guess, maybe too much. And after the program is finished, everybody's welcome to stay for the informal lunch, which we'll just have right in this room. Now, of course, what prompted this forum was that the president recently gave a John Kerry-like speech last Tuesday that essentially said, we will escalate the war before we de-escalate it. And the president, who was against a surge in Iraq, is now imitating that same surge in Afghanistan. The plan seems to be surge, stabilize the cities, and win time to train the Afghan security forces. That is, the hidden message that there is, we're going to contain, but not defeat the Taliban. Now, the president's Afghan plan has some problems, as I see it. Number one, he is assuming that the surge in Iraq worked, which everybody seems to think happened, or at least many people do, and that this same type of surge can be duplicated in Afghanistan. Now, of course, it was this 2000 surge that is perceived to have stabilized Iraq, yet a similar surge of a similar number of troops during 2005 didn't quell Iraqi violence at all. The U.S. military doesn't like to admit that it simply paid the Sunni tribes to change sides and that this was the real factor and main reason for the reduction in violence in Iraq, which I believe will be temporary. Of course, there was also the fact that there was so much ethnic cleansing that the warring ethno-sectarian factions were separated. Now, my prediction in Iraq is that violence will return. There have been periodic, large, multiple bombings like yesterday that indicate that all is not well. Now, the strategy in a short term was a good one, paying off the Sunni awakening, which successfully divided the opposition and got the awakening to attack al-Qaeda instead of the United States. Now, this same strategy of dividing the opposition has actually worked before to win counterinsurgency campaigns. Now, there have been very few counterinsurgency campaigns that have been successful in the 20th century, but the defeat of the Philippine rebels after the Spanish-American War at the turn of the last century, the U.S.-backed Greek government's defeat of the guerrillas in 1947, and the British defeat of the Chinese insurgency in the 1950s, all of those had the thing in common, that they split the opposition. However, in Iraq, the ethno-sectarian fissures are still great, and I don't think the show is over yet. In my book, Partitioning for Peace, which is on what to do about Iraq, I go through some of the other ethno-sectarian conflicts in world history and find that violence sometimes ebbs, but usually always returns unless the underlying issues have been resolved, which they haven't in Iraq. They don't have an oil law, which is their bread and butter commodity. So you can see the level of disagreement in the society. And of course, they've struggled even to get a date for the election. And that didn't happen until recently. Now, even if the surge had been the deciding factor in the reduction of Iraqi violence, the question is, can you transplant that to Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a much different country and a much harder fight to win. Here are some of the reasons. The Taliban has a more zealous insurgency than the former Baathists in Iraq. Afghanistan is a bigger country, has more people in Iraq, and there are fewer forces there. And according to the U.S. military's own rules of counterinsurgency warfare, the U.S. would have to have nearly 600,000 troops in Afghanistan to be effective. Now, of course, that's a rule of thumb, but the basic principle is that we're way under that, and there's no hope that we'll ever get up to that high. So I think we see the daunting task ahead. Iraq is flat. Afghanistan is mountainous, of course, making it much easier for the guerrillas. Unlike Iraq, the Afghan Taliban have a sanctuary in Pakistan, which is supposedly our ally, but which only goes after the Pakistani Taliban and not the Afghan Taliban. Now, the Afghan Taliban is always useful to the Pakistani government to counter the Indian influence in Afghanistan, especially when the U.S. is likely to leave, as the president signaled his intention to at least start pulling out troops by 2011. So that was, I think, a message to the Pakistanis that perhaps they should, elements of the Pakistani military, that they should keep supporting the Afghan Taliban. Now, in Iraq, the insurgency was primarily urban, whereas in Afghanistan, it's rural. Because of the war, the civil war, and the assassinations, in addition, the tribal leadership is weaker in Iraq, or is weaker in Afghanistan than in Iraq, and there's no awakening movement in Afghanistan. The Taliban are Afghans, who for the most part don't target civilians, whereas al-Qaeda in Iraq is led by foreigners, and does purposefully attack civilians to stir up ethno-sectarian hatred. That, of course, alienates has alienated many Sunnis in Iraq. And, of course, in Afghanistan, we have the corrupt Karzai government who stole the election and rules only Kabul. So much of Afghanistan is effectively run by the Taliban. In addition, we've had 8 years where the U.S. has oscillated between a kinetic counterterrorism strategy and a counterinsurgency strategy that tries to protect people. And we've seen the last oscillation of that. This happened during the Bush administration, and now it's happening again in the Obama administration, that we're moving back to a counterinsurgency strategy. Now, besides Afghanistan being a much harder nut to crack than Iraq, we now have a lot of domestic factors affecting U.S. policy. The American public is war-weary after two wars have stretched out over many years, and I think it's politically perilous for any politician in a democracy to escalate a war that is already unpopular. Even LBJ didn't do that when he escalated the Vietnam War. U.S. spending in Afghanistan is more per year than any other military spends on the planet. So we're dumping a lot of resources into Afghanistan. The Afghan war is expected to cost another $1 trillion over the next 10 years. And of course, we're still racking up the bills in Iraq. At the same time, the U.S. is running a $1 trillion annual deficit, budget deficit per year during a recession. We'll probably undertake an expensive healthcare program that will cost between $1 trillion and $2.5 trillion over 10 years, and not to mention the massive solvency problem looming over the Social Security and Medicare systems coming down the road. So it's really questionable whether the U.S. can afford to fight two wars simultaneously under these revised circumstances. Now, the U.S. military has backhandedly admitted that it can't win in Afghanistan, but hopes the surge will allow it to disrupt and degrade, quote unquote, the Taliban, which really means containing the Taliban in urban areas until the Afghan security forces are up to speed. But of course, all the surge troops will not be in place until the fall of next year, giving them only 9 short months until the withdrawal supposedly begins. The Afghan forces are small, corrupt, incompetent, drug-ravaged, and it will take much longer than even the 5 years that Karzai has specified for them to be able to secure the country by themselves. The problem is in Afghanistan, contrary to what people believe, is that you can't conquer Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been conquered many times. The problem is subduing it and controlling it, which it rarely has been. I think you have to go probably back to the Persian Cyrus to find anyone who's actually controlled Afghanistan. And one of the reasons for that is there's disparate groups living spread out, and it's very difficult to control this type of collection of different people. Now, of course, we're only going to train 240,000 Afghans instead of the 400,000 that McChrystal proposed. So, the more U.S. troops that we put in there, the less incentive the Afghans have to train forces themselves. Now, it's not clear to me what stabilizing urban areas will do for the fight against al-Qaeda, since any training camps would probably be in the Taliban-controlled countryside anyway. You don't usually put a big training camp in the middle of downtown somewhere. Now, I've painted an awful portrait of Afghanistan and predicted that Iraq will again erupt into civil strife when the U.S. begins to pull out. Now, what should the U.S. do in each conflict? In my view, in Iraq, the U.S. should sponsor a national conclave and try to decentralize Iraq even further into a loose confederation of very autonomous regions. With Iraq's history of one group's controlling the central government and using it to oppress the other groups, the central government should be made weak so that the ethno-sectarian groups don't fight over controlling it. Most government functions, including security, the judicial systems, and social services, could be in the newly created ethno-sectarian regions. And those regions should not follow the provincial boundaries of Iraq that it has now. This would allow people to be policed and judged by people in their own group. The central government would only be allowed to create an open market among the various regions and do representation overseas. Now, of course, some oil revenue or oil sharing agreement would have to be hammered out to get the Sunnis to accept the devolution of power to the regions. You might have to even move the boundaries around oil fields, et cetera. But an imminent U.S. withdrawal, which we don't have yet, might just catalyze the end of a stalemate on the oil law. Now, contrary to conventional wisdom, my research shows that if countries are partitioned, the regional boundaries don't have to perfectly go along ethno-sectarian lines. To avoid ethno-sectarian violence, you just have to avoid a large minority on the wrong side of the line, which threatens the majority. excuse me. For example, in Kosovo, the Serbs still represent about a little less than 10% of the population, and there really hasn't been that much violence against them since the Kosovo became independent, because their numbers don't threaten the Albanian majority. That's one example. Now, although the U.S. should try to negotiate such a decentralization to a loose confederation in Iraq on its way out, if the Iraqis don't want to do this, that's fine, but I think the U.S. should pull out anyway, because I think this will be Iraq's last hope of more ethno-sectarian violence. And certainly Bush's arming and training of the Sunni awakening will merely in the long term — it was a good short-term strategy to reduce the violence — but in the long term, it may make the civil war more intense, because there'll be a third side armed. The U.S. already armed the Shia and the Kurds and trained those forces. Now, contrary to conventional wisdom, and in spite of its oil, Iraq is not really strategic to U.S. interests. Now, this is a subject which we really can't get into too much in this seminar, but I don't really believe that we need to defend oil with armed forces, because the market will deliver the oil. And that's the subject of my next book, True Slime, the Myth That U.S. Military Interventions Are Needed to Ensure the Flow of Oil. Now, as for Afghanistan, and I know most people are interested in Afghanistan because it's the war of the week. We forgot about Afghanistan while we were doing all this stuff in Iraq, and now that Iraq, the violence has lessened, we're back to our short attention span is back to Afghanistan. Now, I think that the U.S. should also get out of Afghanistan as quickly as possible. And I think it seems as if Obama in this speech is giving it one last college try before the withdrawal begins. But the question remains whether the U.S. security bureaucracies can convince him to stay longer. They always seem to make arguments that he can't refuse to stay longer when U.S. forces get involved. I think that the U.S. needs to realize that Pakistan is more important than Afghanistan. Now, there's some vague awareness of that in this administration, especially on the part of the White House staff and the vice president. Yet for right now, I think they've lost the internal battle. Obama seems to have been persuaded that the U.S. escalation in Afghanistan was needed to convince the Pakistani government to fight the Taliban. But the Pakistan has its own incentives to fight the Pakistani Taliban, an insurgency that aims to overthrow the Pakistani government, but not the Afghanistan Taliban, which the Pakistanis, elements of the Pakistani military, used to counter the Indian influence in Afghanistan. And of course, you can't restructure Pakistan's security priorities. India is a nuclear-armed power, and that's Pakistan's major enemy. And so fighting terrorism, I would say, maybe even in their own country, is secondary to the Pakistan. It's certainly secondary in the mind of the Pakistani military. Now, Pakistan is a nuclear-armed country as being challenged with the new militancies that is being fueled, in my view, by the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and attacks into Pakistan, just as the presence has fueled the Taliban resurgence. If you examine the timeline, the Taliban resurgence didn't seem to begin until 2006. Now, in 2005, U.S. forces moved out of Kabul into the countryside. So I think something similar is happening to what happened in the Soviet period, where the more troops that the Soviets put in just created more Mujahideen fighters against them. Now, Obama has recently said that drone strikes outside the tribal areas and special forces raids to hit Afghan Taliban targets in Pakistan will be used, or at least threatened, if the Pakistanis don't do something about it. I think this will drive Pakistan public opinion crazy. And, I think these sorts of strikes should be limited to getting al-Qaeda people and the lightest footprint that we can possibly have. Now, of course, Pakistan does provide, or at least people think that it provides shelter for Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda central leadership. Somebody in the Pakistani military probably knows where he is, and the Pakistanis certainly avoid fighting the Afghan Taliban or trying to capture or kill its leaders. The Pakistanis have their own agenda, and I think one of the reasons that that Gates and Clinton were walking back Obama's pledge to begin withdrawing U.S. forces in mid-2011, which of course is designed to prod Karzai to make reforms, was the realization that the Pakistani military, if they know that the U.S. is going to leave, would have no incentive not to accelerate the helping of the U.S. enemy, the Afghan Taliban, to forestall Indian influence. Now, of course, McChrystal said yesterday that this withdrawal date wasn't important to his strategy, which basically blows the message to Karzai that we'll be leaving. So they're sending sort of a muddled message. I don't think Obama, he doesn't necessarily have to say that the U.S. is going to withdraw, because the Pakistanis have already experienced the U.S. inherent limited attention span, which we don't ever really acknowledge too much in the United States, which has happened time and time again. So our chief ally in the region will probably continue supporting our chief enemy in the region, which is kind of a bizarre thing to have happen, if you know what I mean, but that's what's going on, right? The Taliban will not be defeated, and it will outweigh the United States. But what if the Taliban weren't our enemy? What's my solution to this problem? What I would say is that we need to distinguish between the Taliban, which is a local insurgency, and al-Qaeda, which is a worldwide insurgency terrorist group that is targeting the U.S. And that's a big difference, because when you're a guerrilla group, you hold territory. And when you hold territory, you can be deterred a lot more than you can be if you're a terrorist group, and you can't be threatened. We don't want to repeat what we did in the Cold War, but it seems like what we're doing. We remember when we thought all communists were the same, but then, there were the Chinese communists, and then there were the Soviet communists, and then there were, of course, communists like Tito and those types of communists, which we eventually kind of, both the Chinese and the Yugoslav communists, we sort of made friends with, at least to some extent, to prod our Soviet enemy. In fact, Richard Nixon made friends with the more radical Chinese to, in sort of a, not an alliance, but a loose alignment to counter the Soviets. So I think we have to distinguish. All these people aren't the same. And a lot of the rhetoric, even that we're getting from the administration, seems to think that they are. So what do we do? Well, I would try to buy off what Taliban you can as a way to minimize casualties and lower violence so that we can get out. You have to accept the eventual reality that the Taliban will help govern or govern Afghanistan. I would rely on the Afghan Taliban's chief support of the Pakistani military to make sure that they don't harbor al-Qaeda. The Taliban should have learned its lesson that harboring al-Qaeda will bring the U.S. hammer down. And, of course, we still have options. We could invade again, although this time we wouldn't remain. We could use the threat of periodic airstrikes, something that any Taliban government would like to avoid if they're trying to govern the country, because they do hold territory and we can't hold them accountable. And, you know, if the Taliban plays ball with us and doesn't harbor al-Qaeda, then we leave it alone. Now, the British press has reported that in prior negotiations with the Taliban, it recognized U.S. interest in not having al-Qaeda sheltering Afghanistan. And, of course, in the vast Taliban-controlled parts of Afghanistan, the Taliban hasn't been harboring al-Qaeda in training camps. And so that gives some cause for hope. People do learn their lesson. When the Germans and the Japanese had their countries bombed into rubble, they changed sides. I'm not saying that the Taliban would necessarily do that, but certainly they may be much more pragmatic than we think. Now, to give the Pakistanis an incentive to pressure any Taliban government not to harbor the Taliban, we could, or not to harbor al-Qaeda, excuse me, we could offer to mediate what Pakistan wants most, and that is a resumption of the talks with its rival, much more powerful rival, India. Now, if the Pakistanis do this, and they also produce the al-Qaeda leadership, the U.S. could even offer to pressure India to make a permanent peace with Pakistan. Now, if Pakistan doesn't play ball and doesn't pressure the Afghan Taliban not to harbor al-Qaeda, the U.S. simply could realign with India, end all bilateral aid to the Pakistanis, and end all U.S. support for World Bank and IMF support for the sagging Pakistani economy. Now, also, I think the Pakistani insurgency will be attenuated when the U.S. leaves Afghanistan, because what drives the Islamists crazy is non-Muslim occupation of Muslim soil, which, of course, is what the U.S. has been doing, and the exact opposite of what we should have been doing after 9/11. Excuse me. Finally, the al-Qaeda central leadership, of course, could move to Yemen or Somalia, so Afghanistan is not any more important than the other countries as a potential shelter. Now, the administration just made the argument that winning in Afghanistan, where the 9/11 attacks emanated from, will embolden the Islamic militants and harm U.S. prestige. Now, I think these are similar to some of the arguments that were made during the Vietnam War. If Vietnam went to the communists, you know, all these bad things would happen, which never really happened. Now, I think we can continue to use law enforcement, intelligence, airstrikes, and special forces to contain al-Qaeda in any of those potential sanctuaries, and including Afghanistan and Pakistan if we have to. And I think containing the Taliban instead of just containing al-Qaeda actually makes the problem worse, because you have the foreign occupation. So, excuse me, but I think we need to pressure Pakistan and get them to do what they can. Now, if they don't do what we can, then we need to keep al-Qaeda contained with the least footprint available. So, excuse me, doing no harm should be the first U.S. objective, and I'm afraid we're not doing that. We actively encourage Islamic militancy in the Cold War years as a bulwark against atheistic communism, but we're still doing that inadvertently by occupying Muslim soil. And bin Laden must be pleased by both Obama's surge and Bush's excursion into Iraq. So I think we need a lighter touch and concentrate on counterinsurgency and drop the counterterrorism and drop the counterinsurgency. And I think we'll be much better off. Now, there's no perfect solution, but that's what I have in mind. So we'll go now to our second speaker, Peter Galbraith.
Ivan, thank you for that presentation. I apologize for being a few minutes late, the vagaries of the shuttle in this weather, which in the Northeast is less good than it is here. Let me just begin by picking up on the broader theme that you raise, which is the question of question that has intrigued me, I suppose, having worked in so many divided states and observed the policies that we follow. Almost invariably, the United States has an extraordinary commitment to the continued existence of every state that exists. This was most prevalent in 1991 when George H.W. Bush did everything he could to hold the Soviet Union together, including going to Kiev on the 1st of August of that year to warn the Ukrainians against nationalism, a speech that became known as the Chicken Kiev speech. It was an extraordinary commitment of U.S. prestige and diplomacy at a time when it was just unrivaled in the world to a cause that was totally hopeless and in which we actually had no interest, because within the month, Ukraine was independent. The same error was made with very tragic consequences in Yugoslavia, where James Baker went on the 21st of June, 1991, to warn the leaders of the six republics of the then Yugoslavia that if they broke up the country, that those who broke away could expect no sympathy from the U.S. But at that point in time, the people of Slovenia and Croatia had already voted overwhelmingly for independence. The leaders, Tudjman in Croatia and Kuchan in Slovenia, were their whole being was about independence. The date was set for the 25th, 4 days later, and of course they went ahead. And it was not possible at that time, or indeed many months in advance, to have saved Yugoslavia. And there was no point in trying to save Yugoslavia. The world is not worse off, in fact, I think it's better off that there's no Soviet Union. It's not worse off that there's no Yugoslavia. But the tragedy of the Yugoslav situation was not the breakup of the country, but the violence. And the violence was definitely preventable in the spring and early summer of 1991. The holding Yugoslavia together was not a possibility. And we continue with this commitment to the unity of every state that exists, so that, for example, in Iraq, one of our major objectives, as stated by the second President Bush, was the unity of Iraq. And yet, there is a part of the country, Kurdistan, in which every single person there, at least everyone that I've met, and this was also expressed in a referendum that was held at the time of the first Iraqi elections, which, every Kurd I've met favors independence. That includes those who hold prominent positions in the central government in Baghdad. And in a referendum that the Kurds held at this time of the January 30th, 2005 elections, they voted 98% for independence. It was obviously a non-binding referendum. And so again, I would say that the interest that we have in Iraq is not in the unity of the country, but in avoiding violence. Now, there are obviously circumstances where the continuation of the state, of a state, may also be related to avoiding violence, and to some degree that may be true in Iraq. Certainly, had the Kurdistan declared itself independent in 2003, that would have produced a very violent reaction from Turkey. But as the situation has evolved in Turkey's thinking, you had extraordinary statement by General Kenan Evren, who was the last military dictator of Turkey, staged the coup in 1980. As military men do, they made himself president. He was the guy who launched the crackdown on the Kurds in southeast Turkey. This was a time when to describe the people of southeast Turkey as Kurds was illegal. They were mountain Turks. But recently he said, what's this business about an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq? Of course it exists. We have to get used to it. And incidentally, it's not a threat to Turkey. Now, again, I'm not saying that Turkey would, if Kurdistan declared itself independent tomorrow, that Turkey would be very enthusiastic about it. But there's a clear evolution in that situation. The other frame with which we discuss these problems is that we tend to describe the people of these areas by the state. The number of times that I heard the phrase Yugoslavs from people. I can assure you I never met a Croat who ever accepted that he was a Yugoslav. There were a few people of mixed, products of mixed marriages who described themselves as Yugoslavs. You're not going to contradict me on that one. there might have been some Serbs who had described themselves that way, but not so many. I mean, a certain number of Bosnians, Muslims, but fundamentally, this isn't how they looked at it. This was really a construct that we had. We also referred to Soviets and Czechoslovaks, and we referred to Iraqis. Virtually every Kurd, if you call him an Iraqi, he or she is offended. And frankly, this sort of break describes how we view the country. I listened to you describing Iraq as flat. Well, that's true for the part of Iraq that thinks of itself as Iraq. But if you look at the map, that isn't strictly speaking true.
It's flatter than Afghanistan, right?
Parts of Afghanistan are flat, and incidentally, the flat parts, at least in the south, is where much of the problem is. If you then sort of stop at the filter of looking at existing states and also consider nationalities, it gives you a rather different picture, and it shows, I think, why, in fact, we were never going to lose the Iraq War in the sense that there was never going to be a moment. Well, we were going to lose it if our objective was the unity of Iraq, or a stable, peaceful, democratic, unified Iraq. Yes, okay, but we weren't going to lose it in the picture that was painted by former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, who said, "Imagine what would happen if Al Qaeda, if we pulled out and Al Qaeda would be taking." Taking over in Baghdad. The image evoked was from Vietnam, those North Vietnamese tanks knocking down the open gates of the presidential palace in Saigon. That wasn't going to happen in Iraq. Simple demographics. 60% of the population are Shiite, and they were in control of the army. It's, of course, a Shiite army that controlled the south. They weren't. There was no way that the Al Qaeda Ba'athist insurgency was going to be able to defeat them. And the Kurds, who had, certainly a few years ago, and maybe even still today, the strongest military in Iraq, they weren't going to be defeated by the al-Qaeda element. There was no support among the Shiites for al-Qaeda or the Salafis, who view the Shiites as apostates and people who should be killed. The Kurds, there was virtually no support in Kurdistan. So we're talking about a problem that existed in about 20% of the population. And of course, the problem solved itself when the fundamentalist element, who the local power structure, the Ba'athists, were very happy to have them come, as long as they were killing Americans, the joining and killing Americans, that was great. As long as they were killing Shiites, hey, that was fine, even if there were big massacres of Shiite civilians. But then they began to shake down the sheikhs for money. They began to demand their daughters in forced marriages, and they began to kill the local tribal sheikhs. At that point, these guys said, well, we've had enough, and they asked the Americans for money. They didn't need to ask for weapons. And in a very short period of time, they were able to defeat them. And that is the situation in Iraq. I don't know whether after U.S. withdrawal it will dissolve into violence. I think there's a certain innate stability to what has happened, precisely because Iraq does already have an extremely decentralized constitution in which it is a confederation. At least it's a confederation between Arabs and Kurds. In which Kurdistan has all the trappings of an independent state, including its own army, its own legislature, its own flag. Only recently, when the Iraqi flag was redesigned, did they allow it to fly there. Its own immigration. You need a visa to go to Iraq, but you don't need a visa to go to Kurdistan. And the fact that it has all the trappings of an independent state, frankly, reduces the incentive to go for formal independence. As between the Sunnis and the Shiites, they do think of themselves as Iraqis, and I don't think you can think of a symmetric devolution of power in that country. The other thing about Iraq, so it, basically the Iraqi system allows those who really want to govern their own affairs and be independent to be independent. And those who don't, they don't have to. And at the center, it had with the supermajority system and the allocation of positions, each of these groups is represented in the central government. So while a Shiite is going to be the prime minister, he doesn't choose the other ministers. If there are 20 ministers, 10 of them will be Shiites. 5 will be Kurds, but it will be the Kurdistan nationalist parties that choose the Kurdish ministers, and the Sunni parties choose the Sunni ministers. And so the bargaining takes place within the cabinet. It quite often issues are not resolved, but on the whole, I think it's not a bad system, and I think I'm more optimistic that there will not, that the real danger of violence in Iraq, which is violence among these organized statelets, if you will, the Kurdistan, Shiistan, Sunnistan. I think that there's a very good chance that will not happen. Let me turn to Afghanistan, which has obviously been at the center of my thinking for the last year. One of the problems of Afghanistan is that it has a government structure that is completely unsuited to the country. And incidentally, there are a lot of similarities between Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, you have the three groups. In Afghanistan, there are four. The Pashtuns at about 45%, the Tajiks at 25%, the Hazaras, who are Shiite, at 10, the Uzbeks at 5. Both countries have some Turkmens. But you have the more violent south, the relatively more stable north. But whereas in Iraq you have both a high degree of local self-government and a system that entrenches power sharing at the center, in Afghanistan you have a Napoleonic constitutional structure, highly centralized in the sense that the central government appoints the governors, all the ministers, the education department at the local level is controlled from Kabul. There's not a local authority. The provincial councils are effectively just advisory bodies. And there's also a winner-take-all system at the center. So you have an election for president, somebody wins, and that person then exercises basically all power. There's quite a weak parliament. The president controls the Supreme Court. President controls, and this turned out to be critically important, the Independent Election Commission. And the other structures of government. Now, at least that's how it works in theory. In reality, of course, since it's a very diverse country, both ethnically and geographically, what this really means is that the president doesn't control large parts of the country. The Tajik areas are, on the ground, significantly self-governing. That's true of the Hazara regions. And when you get to the Pashtun regions, and one of the points to make here is that we talk about the Taliban, it is almost exclusively a Pashtun movement. So it operates only among the 45% of the country that are Pashtuns. And thus, the north is, and the central highlands, certainly the central highlands, and to a lesser extent, the north are relatively stable. One of the things, and this was proposed by Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, who was the Karzai's principal challenger. Interestingly, a man who was one of the few true Afghans, in the sense that his father was a Pashtun and his mother was a Tajik. But in spite of that, he was actually thought of by everybody as a Tajik. There was no shared identification among the Pashtuns with him. But what he proposed, and what I think makes sense, is that there be entrenched power sharing by devolving power, by taking significant powers away from the president, having a cabinet, a prime minister and cabinet chosen by the parliament, with the same kind of bargaining that takes place in Iraq. In truth, what Afghanistan needs is an Iraqi-style constitution, also with elected local government. Now, I want to emphasize in the case of both Iraq and the United States, Afghanistan, it's really not for the United States to impose any solution. Yes, there's, given the significant investment, particularly that we have in Afghanistan, we're transitioning out of Iraq. ours was a unwelcome invasion of Iraq, except by the Kurds. It's really, and the dynamic is very different. The way we're viewed is different. So our ability to shape events, political events in Iraq, is much less, and I would very much urge a lower profile there. But in the case of Afghanistan, we're ramping up. It's very much welcomed. It's essential for the Karzai government to its survival. And it's not unreasonable to say, well, we have 100,000 troops there, there are additional 30,000 from NATO, we're spending all this money, that we expect something. And what is it that we ought to expect? Well, we ought to expect a credible partner. And the problem is that credible partner does not exist. The Karzai administration has, for the last 8 years, been characterized by ineffectiveness and toleration of corruption. Now it's in office by virtue of massive fraud, and it is seen as illegitimate, and rightly seen as illegitimate, by a large segment of the Afghan population, because it actually didn't Karzai didn't win those elections. It isn't, incidentally, that the Electoral Complaints Commission took Karzai slightly below 50% and Abdullah gave up because he recognized it was hopeless. The Electoral Complaints Commission did a statistical sample because all it needed to do was to bring him below 50%. There could be a runoff. It didn't need to determine how many votes he actually got. But based on what I know from the staff is that Karzai's vote was probably around 41%, not 49%. And Abdullah's was not that much far behind, maybe 35%. So this was a much closer contest. I think Abdullah was right not to go to the second round because the Independent Election Commission was moving to increase the number of polling centers when the root of the problem was ghost polling centers, that is, polling centers that never opened, never existed, producing a million phony ballots, because it rehired. In every case, the fraud was either perpetrated by the Election Commission staff or they collaborated with those who did the fraud, or they knew of the fraud and didn't report it, and every one of those people who were responsible for the staff were being rehired. In fact, a little aside, exactly one person has lost his job over fraud in the Afghanistan elections. And that wasn't one of the people who committed the fraud. In any event, the result of this process is that we don't have a credible partner. That's the missing link in President Obama's strategy. And it's what makes it so difficult to implement. The idea of protecting the troops, okay, of protecting the population, okay, you can do that. You can clear the Taliban out of an area, that's hard. But then you need something to happen, otherwise you're going to be there forever. Specifically, what you need is for there to be an Afghan army to come in and help you secure it and eventually to take over. You need an Afghan police to provide order. And then you need an Afghan government, or some kind of government, that can provide public services, honest administration, and can win the trust of the people. The Karzai government can't do that, won't do it. And the way in which most Afghans experience government, there's a lot of talk in Washington about corruption, and that's there, of course, but that isn't the main point. The main way they experience is as abuse of power, people operating with impunity. And it isn't just government officials. It's really the local power brokers. And again, one of the applying our cultural standards, we imagine that if you're out of office, you're out of power. So if we think there's a corrupt governor or an abusive governor, we want to get him out of office. But it doesn't change things because the guy still actually runs things. The difficulty we face here is that once you have, the dilemma is that once you've gotten, I mean, even if you've removed these guys, they're still in power, and once the population has lost confidence in the government, even if you could miraculously get honest administration, it doesn't mean that you're going to regain the confidence of the people. That's the problem. Because in order for somebody to sign up on the government side, they basically put their lives at risk. Because the Taliban basically leaves the elders alone unless they're aligned with the government. So you would need a large critical mass to simultaneously go over to the government side, and that's very hard. So I don't see that this piece is going to be readily fixed. I do think meaningful elected local self-government will help, but it's by no means a panacea. Let me just say a word about the police, and then just a word to respond to what Evan said about Pakistan. On the issue of the police, there's a real dilemma here, which is that we have an 8-week training course for police, which is relatively short, but if you want to get large numbers, you can't train them for long periods of time. Trouble is you have people who come in who the first few weeks are spent on basic things like basic hygiene, what is required when a whole bunch of men live together. And then most of them are illiterate. And so if you really wanted to get a higher quality police, you'd have to have a multi-year training course that included such things as teaching them how to read and write. But if you did that, at the end of the process, you would have a relatively educated person who wouldn't want to be a policeman. So, and these are some of the dilemmas we face. And some of these dilemmas, I won't go into it, come from imposing our idea of what the Afghan army should be, what our idea of the Afghan police should be. Ambassador Mort Abramowitz has raised this, and I won't go further, but he does observe that Afghans they are not unknown for their fighting prowess, and how is it that we need to spend so much time training them how to fight? Let me turn to the question of Pakistan. The extraordinary thing about the U.S. relationship with Pakistan is that the Pakistanis remember everything and the Americans remember nothing. And as a result, we simply adopt the Pakistani narrative of what happened. And that narrative is of the U.S. as an unfaithful ally, that we lost interest. Well, that isn't how it happened. The U.S. having embraced Pakistan in the 1981 after the Soviet invasion, Pakistan then made a commitment to the United States. That General Zia came and he said, Pakistan has neither the means nor the intention of developing a nuclear explosive device. Congress put this into law, and I had a lot to do with that, actually. That was simply putting his promise, his commitment, which nobody made him offer, into law. They knew that if they crossed the line on the nuclear program that their weapons and aid would be cut off. And they did, and it was cut off. And we now are in deep apology mode for their breaking their commitment. And that reflects, I think, the larger problem of the relationship, which is that we have always viewed it as Pakistan is doing something for us, and we have to, and therefore, you know, we are not sufficiently grateful. And that more or less is the Pakistani narrative. But the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was a lot bigger threat to Pakistan than it was to the United States. And we might have approached it by saying to Pakistan, to General Zia, well, if you want our help, here's our conditions, and we expect you to keep them. Instead, we approached them from a position of weakness, and we said, if you will sign up with us in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, you know, we'll provide all these goodies. And Zia said, yes, and I want to control it. And, of course, the most significant thing he wanted to control was to decide who among the Afghans got the U.S. assistance. And he gave them to the very people that hate us the most, that are our enemies. And incidentally, no Soviet ever attacked us from Afghanistan. But, of course, the very people that we funded, and we funded because Pakistani, as Zia insisted we fund them, were the people who ultimately were responsible for or contributed significantly to the attacks on the United States. And the same, frankly, blank check approach was applied toward Musharraf in the Bush administration. There is, however, no easy solution to the problem in Pakistan because Pakistan is a divided country. It's certainly divided ethnically. With a significant independence movement in Balochistan, late separatism in Sindh, and the fact that the Pashtuns are on both sides of the border. But it's also divided horizontally in the sense that there's a civilian government, but there's also the army, which has run things formally for half of Pakistan's history and informally for the other half, or most of the other half. There's the ISI, which operates within the army. And then there's the supposedly rogue elements of the ISI. So if we were to lay down some of these conditions, threaten to cut off aid to Pakistan, who would we be hurting? And would we be serving our interest? I would argue that, in fact, our interest lies in strengthening Pakistan's civilian government. I know there are many criticisms of the president, and he's a less than perfect human being, but the fact is it would be awfully good if Pakistan had one civilian government that actually served its term and then left office rather than being overthrown. And the civilian government has a different approach to India than the military. The Pakistani military, I mean, you spoke of it as a India is the enemy. Well, it's interesting. If you talk in Pakistan to the military, actually, if you talk to them almost any subject, flower arrangements, and within a few minutes, the subject of India will come up. You could spend all day in India talking about security issues, and the subject of Pakistan does not come up. India has moved on. Pakistan's military has not. And of course, their well-being depends on the Indian threat. That's the raison d'etre. And it is why they do incredibly reckless things, like support terrorists who are responsible for a number of attacks in India, including the Mumbai attacks, which are the one thing that could lead to a Pakistan-India war, and why they believe it's useful to be fighting India in Afghanistan, both against the Pashtuns, against the Tajiks, and the Taliban against the Karzai government. As tempting as it would be to think of Pakistan as a unitary actor subject to pressure, it just doesn't work that way. And so I think we have to operate with the reality of Pakistan, and that reality is that we will be much better off if democracy really takes root in the country, if it becomes institutionalized, if the civilian government can gain a measure of control over the military, and that's not impossible. Some of the shift that's taken place this year in terms of the military fighting the Pakistani Taliban, which they were reluctant to do, is under pressure and direction from the civilians. Pakistan was much less engaged in Afghanistan during this election period than it had been in 2004. And that was the civilian government's policy decision that they didn't want to be involved. Again, it's far from perfect. But it's not impossible. And I think over time, what we want to see is strengthened civilian government in Pakistan, and for it then to pursue some of the ideas that President Zardari has, but are shared by other Pakistani politicians, of cooperation with India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, a regional market, even Pakistan providing infrastructure for India. Let me stop there and...
Thanks, Peter, for an interesting presentation. And now we'll go to our third speaker, Chuck Pena, who's a senior fellow here at the Institute.
Good afternoon. Ivan hasn't given me a time limit, but since I know I stand between you and two important things, first questions, second lunch, I will do my best to keep my remarks relatively brief. Peter, to address the first part of your remarks, I am Californian by birthright, Northern California specifically, since you talked about how people identify. I also want to congratulate Ivan for being pretty prescient about scheduling this particular event. He and I actually talked about this maybe 6 weeks or so ago, and who would know that it would happen the week after President Obama decided to make his speech about ramping up troops in Afghanistan. The title of today's event is Can We Withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan? I'm going to focus my remarks mostly about Afghanistan, but I would say 80 to 90% of what I have to say you could probably just transfer over and wholesale to Iraq. So I thought it was interesting that Ivan chose that the term can we withdraw. The simple answer is yes, absolutely, no problem. All the president has to do is make a decision. I mean, whenever talk about military withdrawal comes up, everybody throws up all the reasons you can't do it, how complicated it is, and you know, all the politics involved. The bottom line is the commander-in-chief can make the decision. All he or she has to do is make it. And then he tells the Secretary of Defense, who then works with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the COCOMs, make it happen. It's that simple. So the answer to can we withdraw is yes, always has been yes. You just have to have the political will to make the decision to withdraw. So then the next question that comes up then is, well, okay, if you know, how do you do that, right? I mean, it's a logistical nightmare, and yeah, it is, particularly in Iraq at the moment. It is a bit of a logistical nightmare. But in Afghanistan, you can withdraw, and let me suggest. The president has said that he would like to begin withdrawal of troops in Afghanistan in roughly 18 months. At two brigades a month, which is not unreasonable, which is about that's an average rotation that's not unreasonable at all. At two brigades a month, we can be out in less than 18 months out of Afghanistan. In fact, we can probably be out in close to a year if you made that decision now to draw down at roughly two brigades. Two brigades, by the way, is about 7,000 troops, depending on whether it's combat or combat support. So the how is also fairly doable, and you tell the folks on the joint staff, figure out the logistics, you work with the COCOM to figure it all out, and you find a way to bring the troops out. Of course, part of the problem, particularly in Iraq, is the equipment. How do you get the equipment out? Because we've got a lot of heavy equipment in there now. We have less so in Afghanistan, so it's probably a little bit easier. But again, not logistically easy, but logistically doable. And I would suggest that if you made the decision today that you wanted to withdraw rather than ramp up in Afghanistan, you could be out in less than 18 months, which is when the president says he would actually like to begin withdrawing forces from Afghanistan. So if you can do it, because it's just simply a decision, and how you do it is doable, what it really comes down to is, should you? I mean, really, and so maybe and the more appropriate question is, should we withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan? Rather than belabor the point on Iraq, let me focus on Afghanistan, although, as I said, I think at least strategically the logic applies pretty equally to both. The answer to should we withdraw is yes, okay? And let me walk through an argument as to why that answer is yes. First of all, the proposed ramp-up of troops, 30,000, which is less than what General McChrystal wanted. He wanted 40,000. The president and his advisors decided 30,000 instead of 40,000, and General McChrystal, being the good general, has saluted, said, yes, sir, I can still win with 30,000, even though I asked for 40,000 troops. It's not enough. Ivan alluded to this. It's both the rule of thumb. It's what General Petraeus, General McChrystal's superior officer, wrote in the counterinsurgency manual that the United States military now uses. And it's what history has demonstrated. You need about 20 soldiers per every 1,000 civilians to be able to effectively run a counterinsurgency operation. In Afghanistan, with a population of more than 30 million people, you're looking at a force, a footprint, of more than 600,000 troops required to run an effective counterinsurgency. We don't have 600,000 ground forces in the United States Army. You could combine the active duty Army and Marines and get to 600,000, but there's no way that we can get to that number if we had to. And so the roughly 100,000 U.S. troops after the surge, give or take, plus the NATO troops, enough to do what in terms of counterinsurgency? Enough to occupy Kabul and keep Hamid Karzai ensconced as the mayor. Enough maybe to occupy two or three more provinces in Afghanistan, but not enough to occupy the country, not enough to run an effective counterinsurgency. So what happens when you have a small force trying to run counterinsurgency? You play whack-a-mole. you subdue the enemy in one area, and then when you say, hey, we've got pacification, you move on to the next area, and as you move on to the next area, what generally happens is the place you pacified before, violence erupts there. Why? Because there's nobody there minding the store. Of course, the solution that the president has proposed, which is, by the way, the same solution that President Bush proposed in Iraq, is we will train the Afghans to take control of their own security during the Bush administration is, you know, as they stand up, we'll stand down. That is exactly what President Obama is proposing in Afghanistan. So, A, you don't have enough troops to run effective counterinsurgency. You may or may not have enough to run an effective counterterrorism strategy in Afghanistan. So that's problem number one, and a reason why we should withdraw rather than stay. Number two, no political leader in the United States has ever admitted to the American public what's required to run an effective counterinsurgency. Okay? We make it sound as though if we just put in enough troops, and Obama also talked about bringing in more civilians, there's also going to be a civilian surge, State Department and other services, that, you know, we'll just do this in a kinder, gentler way. You know, we will provide all these services and schools and all, you know, running water and all the amenities that people like. They'll love us and won't turn against us as a result. So between the military and the civilians, you know, we'll win. Well, that's not really how it's done, or at least that's not what history tells us. History tells us that when you run effective counterinsurgency, you kill lots of people. Okay, and if you don't kill them, you incarcerate them, and that you engage in broad brush, relatively harsh tactics to do that. Because what's the point of counterinsurgency is to impose security and order. And you do that any way you can. And it doesn't matter how much collateral damage is involved. It doesn't matter whether you're killing or locking up the right people. What matters is that you're imposing order and security. That is the whole point of running a counterinsurgency operation. You don't do that by killing people with kindness. You do that by using military force. And that's exactly what history has demonstrated. If you look at the British, who are often acknowledged as the experts in counterinsurgency, mostly because they used to have lots of colonies and had to run counterinsurgency operations to have security in their colonial empire. That's what the Brits did. It's not very pretty. It's ugly, and it runs counter to how we believe what we believe we are as a country, which is why presidents, not just this president, any president, doesn't admit to the American public what's required to run an effective counterinsurgency, and so they dress it up in a lot of different ways that are politically more palatable. So, you know, do we have enough troops, and are we willing to engage in the kinds of tactics that are necessary to win? And I think the answer there is no, we're not. Number three, how long do we have to stay? Okay, we've already been in there eight years, okay, not sort of as has been suggested, oscillating, going back and forth between, you know, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, relatively small footprint, let's ramp up, now let's ramp up even more. Again, the history of counterinsurgency is 5 to 7 years, okay? 5 to 7 years with enough troops engaged in the kind of operations that you really need to engage in. That is not what President Obama has proposed. He's even said, much to his credit, he does not want this to be an open-ended nation-building mission. Okay? And I applaud him for that. But if you're going to run effective counterinsurgency, you better plan to be there for a minimum of 5 years. And oh, by the way, the Brits were in Malaysia for 20 years running their counterinsurgency operations there. You better be willing to be there for a long time. This is already an unpopular war with the American public. What are the odds that the American public is going to be willing to put up with 5, 7, 10, 20 more years of this? So from a tactical perspective, I don't think we can win. So those are, I think, three strong tactical reasons to withdraw. But most importantly, the one that trumps those three is that strategically it's not in our interest to stay. Both Peter and Ivan have talked a little bit about this, but occupation is what fuels resentment, which is what creates terrorists. It creates terrorists in the territory that you're occupying, and as we saw with 9/11, it creates terrorists who may decide that they want to strike you at home, away from the territory that you're occupying. And so, since the whole point of having gone into Afghanistan in the first place, which I would argue we had to do at the time, but since the whole point is to try and reduce the terrorist threat to the United States, not increase the terrorist threat to the United States, at this point in time, 8 years later, having not really achieved the objectives that we wanted to achieve when we first went into Afghanistan, it is now high time for the U.S. to leave and let Afghanistan be run by the Afghans, however imperfect that might be. Okay, our only criteria has to be that the government, whichever government it is, whether it's the Karzai government, whether it's a Taliban government, that any government in Afghanistan not openly provide aid and shelter to al-Qaeda, and that if they decide to do that, we come back and we do this all over again, which, by the way, is cheaper for those of us who may be, you know, worried about the costs. It's cheaper for us to leave, and if things get out of hand again, just come back and do it all over again, than it is for us to stay, to try and make something work that maybe we can't make work. So here are the issues. Number one, both Peter and Ivan have talked about this. The Taliban is not monolithic. We here in the United States tend to equate the Taliban with al-Qaeda. They're not one and the same. There are elements of the Taliban that would support al-Qaeda wanting to attack the United States. There are other elements of the Taliban. Look, they're just interested in having a say in the government in Afghanistan. We've got to stop treating them monolithically as a single threat, as this somehow they are a threat to the United States of America proper. They're not. So we have to be willing to live with less than perfect in terms of what happens in Afghanistan. And I also think that we also have to be willing to concede at this point that what's left of al-Qaeda, whether they're operating out of Pakistan or coming across the border periodically into Afghanistan, and by the way, I saw a news report that supposedly even bin Laden, assuming he's still alive, finds his way across the border into Afghanistan periodically. Al-Qaeda isn't the same al-Qaeda that existed, that attacked us on 9/11. And bin Laden, in particular, does not have operational control over a group that has global reach that can attack the United States. Our larger problem is not Osama bin Laden and what's left of al-Qaeda hiding out in Pakistan. Our larger problem is the ideology of radical Islam, which has seeped into the Muslim world in part because we've helped propagate that by our actions in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So I would argue whatever benefit there might be to getting bin Laden at this point, and believe me, I would love to be able to say that we got Osama bin Laden. But strategically, the costs required to try and get bin Laden and contain al-Qaeda, the costs far outweigh any residual benefit at this stage and point, given that bin Laden, as bin Laden, and the people surrounding him no longer represent operationally the real threat to the United States. The real threat is sort of everywhere within the Muslim world, being fueled by ideology and anti-American sentiment. And so this notion of denying al-Qaeda safe havens in Afghanistan, I think, is a pie-in-the-sky notion. Al-Qaeda, there will be some safe havens. Why? Because there will always be people who have sympathies and decide they want to support groups like al-Qaeda. The question is, are they local threats or global threats? As long as they're local threats, then those are threats that the Afghan government has to deal with and ones that we may have to live with. Again, less than perfect. It's the global threat that al-Qaeda may represent that we have to worry about. I think we have to worry about that less now than we did 8 years ago. I think we have to worry more about that. We are radicalizing Muslims around the world, as witnessed by the bombings in Madrid and London in particular, and that our very presence in two Muslim countries at the moment, Iraq and Afghanistan, goes a long, long way to fueling that radicalism, that it's U.S. occupation that makes us a target, that there may be a certain amount of anti-Western, anti-U.S. elements in radical Islamic ideology, but a lot, most of that is because we're there, we're in their territories, not necessarily that they want to come after the United States in the U.S., and that it doesn't solve all of our problems. I don't want to suggest it's a panacea. And certainly withdrawing from Iraq or Afghanistan doesn't necessarily mean that either country will be a better place from the perspective of Iraqis or Afghans. Old Peter has alluded that maybe he thinks Iraq would be, and I think that would be great. But our concern is not whether Iraq and Afghanistan are better places. Our concern is whether either one of them represents a threat to the United States. The best way, in my opinion, to move in the right direction to ensure that neither country is a threat to the United States is for the U.S. to withdraw, to give Muslims in those countries less reason to want to target the United States, less reason to have sympathy with the ideology of radical Islam. And we would be a much safer country as a result of doing that. So again, let me reiterate, can we withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan? Yes. How do we do it? Yeah, we can do it. It's a little bit logistically complicated, but it's certainly doable. But more importantly, should we withdraw? Absolutely, because that's what's in our strategic interests, and those are the kinds of decisions that any president should be making, the decisions that are in our strategic interest. Thank you.